Scripture reading for this morning will be Jeremiah chapter 10, 6 through 11. Again, the scripture reading for this morning will be Jeremiah chapter 10, 6 through 11. There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For this is your due. For among all the wise ones of the nations and all of their kingdoms, there is none like you. There are both stupid and foolish. The instructions of idols is but wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz. They are the work of the craftsmen and of the hands of the goldsmith. And their clothing is violet and purple. They are all the work of the skilled men, but the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and everlasting King. At this wrath and the earthquakes, and the nations cannot endure his indignation. Thus shall you say to them, the God who did not make the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens.
I want to welcome you here this morning. We appreciate your presence. I know we opened the service with welcoming our visitors, but we want to do it again, let you know the service is going to be over. Yeah, this is the last segment of it. Should be over before 12. For some reason, everything just kind of went quickly this morning, and the sermon's going to probably do the same. We appreciate your presence. We're encouraged by your choice of worshiping with us, your desire to do things as God wants them, and that is edifying for us and uplifting, and we hope to be of some service to you this morning with the lesson. We're continuing on in a series of the Bible as, looking at ways that the Bible is far superior to individual works that men do. As we look at this morning, the theological composition, this is one of those duh things. In looking at the various topics and subject matter where the Bible dwells deeper than most secular writings, perhaps none is more exclusive other than the one we did on salvation, which men would know nothing about, is the topic of the nature of God. Truly, the Bible is the initial and prime source of an insight into deity and deities, containing all that God has wished to reveal about himself. No other covers it more completely and with more authority than the writings of and by God. So when one looks at the nature of God, you can go to no better place than the Bible. It's the only place, and if a man has come up with something, it's just stuff he got from the scriptures. In this lesson, we will take a cursory look at what God reveals about the nature of the Godhead and the nature of other gods, as well as the true worship him versus man-made worship, which is meaning. Now, I've used the word cursory because as we look at the nature of God, there's various things that I've left out as we go through them, and I'll mention that at the end of it. As to the substance of God, Jesus explains, like to the woman of the well, that God is spirit. He's not material, which makes him different really than every other god, you know, that nations worship. The very essence of him is spirit. In Numbers 16:22, the people in the wilderness, when they fell on their faces and said, "Oh God, you are the God of the spirits of all flesh." So he himself is spirit. He made man in his image, in the spirit aspect of it. And he is the God of all spirits. There's none that is regulated to other gods. And God is considered holy, good, and true, as it's mentioned in some of the songs we just got through singing. Jeremiah 10:10, but the Lord is the true God. True in the sense of, yeah, there are other gods mentioned. The Bible pulls up the word little god in mentioning, but they're all fake. You know, we'll look at that a little bit closer. But he's the living God. He's not dead. He's not a piece of stone. He's not something, whatever. He's very viable. He's very ongoing. He was before we were. He's been through all our history. He's going to continue on throughout eternity. Notice something else that that picks up here: the living God and an everlasting King, and His wrath. At His wrath, the earth quakes. So God can be wrathful. God can be vengeful. In Romans, Paul writes that we're not to be vengeful. Leave it to the wrath of God. In Psalms 105, for the Lord is good; His loving kindness is everlasting. It's explaining what good is. In loving kindness, an everlasting loving kindness, His faithfulness to all generations, His promises are faithful. Whatever He said, He's going to be true to it. In fact, what Paul adds to Timothy, when man is not faithful, God still remains faithful. So His faithfulness doesn't depend on us, it depends on Him. We open it with God is holy. That is, He's what Barclay says is the root of the word, different, special, precious, like nothing else. That's what holy implies. Revelation 6:10, and they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood? Here's where His faithfulness comes out. He has promised that He will judge and avenge. So He's faithful in that, which also makes Him holy and true, different than other gods. He does intervene in man's lives. We can call upon Him, and being the one true God, He will act. What God is not, in 1 Chronicles 16:26, for all the gods of the peoples are nothing but idols. Okay, that's what a pagan god is, just an idol. But the Lord made the heavens. The idols can do nothing. They just sit there, smile, whatever. But they do so with lips that don't move. They have eyes, but eyes that do not see. One of the descriptions that Isaiah gives to them. In Acts 17:29, Paul talking in a city of idols. The Greeks came up with all sorts of figures and whatever. They have gods and the fathers of gods, and before that the Titans and everything else. And when Paul saw all these statues erected to all these different gods, he said, we ought not to think that that the divine nature is like gold or silver, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Okay, all these statues, all these idols, whatever, something that men created. And God is not like that. We are like Him. And divine nature is not of silver, gold, or stone. In Isaiah 37, Isaiah is a great one for being sarcastic, and pulling in some irony on the things that are occurring. It says, they've cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood, stone. So they have destroyed them all. Gods can be destroyed. Men's gods can. In Isaiah 44, he makes a very ludicrous illustration. He says, you go out and you chop down a tree. And half of it you chop up and break down and whatever, and you put it in a fire, and fire warms you, and you cook your food over it, and the whole thing serves you. And then with the rest of what's left, you sit there and you carve out an image and you bow down and serve it. Yeah, there's an inconsistency in this. He's trying to get him to see just how nonsensical the whole procedure is of carving up and making idols. 1 Corinthians 10, Paul gives us this insight. I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. So the problem with the idol is, you can't just look at it. And Paul had said that there's nothing in an idol. You look at an idol and there's nothing there. But the problem is, why is the idol there? And that's because men have listened to doctrines of demons. So they're not worshiping this fake God. They're worshiping the demon that's fostered this false teaching that brought it about. In the nature of God, it talks about him as being, in his nature, the things that he does. He's a creator. And it's not just in Genesis we read of this. In the Psalms, you know, in 33, it says, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. That is, he just spoke them into existence. We get this in the New Testament, in Colossians and other places. And by the breath of his mouth, all the host. He didn't have to sit there and roll up his sleeves and toil and sweat at something. He just spoke it and it existed. You know, the amount of power exhibited by God in all creation is trying to be explained in the scriptures, but it's evident also, the psalmist says, in the heavens around us. Just looking out into the stars, how far out do they go? We don't know. I know some try to put a limit on it, that there's an end to the universe, and they say it kind of laps over there. But that's just man's ability or non-ability to imagine something so great and so powerful. When you start looking at just how much power there is in the universe, in fact, we have a wrong impression of it to begin with. We look through a optical telescope, and all you see is like a cold black mass. But when they launched, you know, the electronic telescopes into space and started looking at it, suddenly the sky lit up. It's a phenomenal place of high energy. In fact, our sun is one of the coolest stars around. All the other suns are, you know, intensely, you know, more hot, more vibrant, bigger, and they're imploding, they're turning into novas, supernovas, whatever the hell. It's a very hot place out there. I mean, it just exudes power. And to take it all in and to look at it and realize, you know, men can't do it. You know, conceptualize that an individual, a being, had so much power to be able to speak it into existence. It's beyond their comprehension. And very limited in what they do come up to replace it. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the depths in the storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. Okay, came into being and then stopped. Yeah. By his word. He is also a father. And sometimes we have a concept of, okay, we have kings, therefore, how are we liking God? He's sort of like a king. Or we have fathers of families and, you know, fathers of nations, whatever. Maybe God is sort of like a father. But that's not the way Paul pictures it. He says, for this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name. God was a father before man ever was. God was a king before men conceived of it. They drew the title from him. I mean, God is the ultimate of any kind of position of power or a position of love that anyone could conceive of. And in this, God is a father. You know, not like other gods that are cold and, you know, far away. He sits and loves his creation. He does what he can for it. You know, he tries to teach it. He tries to guide it. He wants what's best for it in every situation. He's faithful in 1 Corinthians 1:9, where it says, God is faithful through whom you were called into the fellowship with his Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. So God is faithful in all things. He is just. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are just. A God of faithfulness and without injustice, he's righteous and upheld. This is something that people don't understand about God. You know, why people argue against his existence. You know, how can God exist and be loving, and allow so many wars and the death of children and whatever? And they use it as an excuse of why God can't exist. And we made this argument before, okay, accept the argument, okay, because of wars and children dying and everything, all the disease that's around, okay, there's no God. Okay, now that you've gotten rid of God, who is responsible for the wars and the death of children and the diseases and everything else? Well, now it comes back to who's really responsible. God didn't create this world with wars in it and children dying. In fact, people live very long. Nor with diseases. All this is the outcome of men's sin and what they do to one another. You know, God is still faithful. He does what's right. He is just. And man has to learn that. That is the nature of God. He is omnipresent, meaning that he's everywhere. 1 Kings 8:27, when Solomon looked at the grand temple that he'd built, a house for God. In fact, it was so spectacular when they rebuilt the temple after coming out of the captivity, the people were disappointed because it wasn't as spectacular as Solomon had built. But Solomon looked at it and goes, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, how much less this house which I have built. Or said by David, heaven is his throne and earth is his footstool. He's everywhere. He is omniscient. Psalms 147, great is our God and abundant in strength. His understanding is infinite. So you look at God being omniscient, his strength has no boundary to it. But what he knows, if you took all of the accumulated knowledge and wisdom of all the men since the beginning of time and lumped it all together, all the Einsteins, the Copernicuses, and all these people, and you lumped them into one little container, all the wisdom of man could not match as a drop in the ocean to the wisdom of God. All that he knows, all that he understands, what we've learned in science, it's just discovering the laws that God had come up with and put into play. Can you imagine an intellect, that understands everything the greatest minds of man understand? And more, infinitely more. That's our God. Omnipotent, and looking at them, Jesus said to them, Jesus just talked about how men live, how they degenerated from God, been divorced, and arguing that there was nothing wrong with it because God gave them, Moses gave them a writing of divorcement. But Jesus said, no, because of the hardness of your heart, you got the divorces. That means you're already gone. The divorce papers were for the innocent. And then, his disciples start, well, who then can be saved? If God is so critical about the way they designed him in marriage, one man, one woman for life, who can be saved? Well, God had a plan. We talked about it last week. The law of the Spirit of life, which takes into account man's sin. With people, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. God can handle our sin. God can handle anything. He's powerful enough to deal with all things. And he is incomprehensible. This is what we've been talking about, Job 11. Can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? Are they high as the heavens? Or they are high as the heavens? What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? God is incomprehensible. He's so great in so many ways. He's so majestic. This is what his glory is, his name is. It just shines forth, like the sun. This is what heaven's going to be like in his presence. The radiance of all things good and just and pure and honorable and whatever, that's what you're going to be basking in for eternity. You will never be disappointed. You'll never be bored. You will always be impressed by the presence of God. When we come to him, there are types of worship, some to do and some to avoid. The confrontation of Elijah with the prophets of Baal shows the accessibility to the one true living God as opposed to the non-relationship of the idol. If you know the story, go to 1 Kings 18. And in fact, it came about when And the king met Elijah on the road and accused him of making trouble in Israel. And he goes, you want trouble? I'll show you. I mean, you bring it to a head, okay? You gather all your priests of Baal and we'll meet on Mount Carmel. And we'll make a distinction now for the people between the God of, you know, the Baals or whatever, you know, the false priest, and the God of Israel. So they built an altar, each to their own god, and those with those priests of Baal, you know, they were calling all day. You know, they built their altar. The point was to see whose god would, you know, actually provide the fire for the sacrifice. And so they were praying all day. They were, you know, beating themselves. They were cutting themselves. You know, it went on all day long. And Elijah is just, you know, keep at it, guys, you know, whatever, you know, he's a god, perhaps he's talking to somebody, perhaps he's away on a trip, perhaps he's off to the, and it literally says off to the side, relieving himself. You know, just keep at it, you know, he's got to be done sometime and come back. I mean, Elijah's really sticking it to him. And when they're all done and nothing has happened, okay, Elijah, and you got to realize the faith of Elijah here, he goes and has them completely drowned his sacrifice in water. And he gets a bucket brigade going and they keep adding the water and they absolutely drown the sacrifice, the altar. There's a whole gutter of water, a lake that's formed around this thing. And he prays to the one true living God. Fire comes out of the world and out of the air and completely consumes the sacrifice, the altar, the water, everything. And the people were speechless. But he showed that the small g gods, the altars, you know, the idols, they don't listen. They're not really anything. But when you're dealing with the one true God, you got a tap into power that's unbelievable. That's awesome. That's breathtaking. That's mind-numbing. You just don't understand what a benefit you have in this life because you can communicate with God. This is the same Elijah that James points to and says, Elijah prayed and for 3.5 years it didn't rain. Then he prayed again and it rained and the earth bore fruit. You know, this is the power a man can harness when he's right with God. And man, and James goes on to make the point of Elijah is not any different than we are, except that he was more believing in his God. Deuteronomy 4:7, for what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God whenever we call upon him? Psalms 145, the Lord is near to all who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth. He will fulfill the desire of those who fear him. He will also hear their cry and save them. And because he's faithful and true, that is a promise he will keep. May not be exactly when we expect it, but he will keep it. We have to believe that. The Lord also explains that there is worship that's from man that's not acceptable. Vain refers to actions that are of no avail, that is, of no profit, that are empty, either to the individual or to God. It's trying to do something, you know, that God hasn't authorized, and you're just beating your head against the wall. The ultimate source of instruction must come from God and God alone. If God didn't reveal himself, man wouldn't even know there was a God. All of it depends on revelation. You know, and God was there revealing himself from the very beginning. He revealed himself to Adam. And he must have instructed them because Cain and Abel realized there was a way to sacrifice properly and a way not to. And they knew the difference. So sacrifice was from the very beginning. A true worship of God was from the very beginning. But it could only be known if God revealed it, told him about his own nature, discussed things with him, told him what was right or wrong. So where does man get off thinking he can do it his way? Jesus said, Matthew 18, this people honors me with their lips. I mean, there's a lot of people that, oh yeah, I believe in God. There's 80% of this nation believes in God. And that's where it stops. Okay? They don't seek to do things his way. They don't approach him the way he asks. Their heart is far away from me. They go about their own lives doing what they want to do and not giving any consideration for the worship service and how special this is for us to be here. And how not to put something else in the way, whether it's family or friends or recreation or whatever. I mean, what did Jesus tell them? He asked one guy to follow him, and he goes, "Hey, my father just died. I got to bury him." Jesus said, "Let the dead bury the dead." Where's your primary importance? Right here. Not family occasions, not graduations, not birthday parties. No matter what's going on in the world, your primary purpose is to be here before God every first day of the week, worshiping the way He instructed you to. In vain emptiness they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. Why do we have so many religion? Precepts of men. Men doing their think-sos. There's also worship that is ignorant. Worship in ignorance is not only vain, but it's also aimless and excessive. If one does not know where they are going, they are concerned about it, they try too many roads. Maybe I should take this one, maybe I ought to go that one. Why don't you stop and consult a road map? It's in the Bible. God gave it to us. In Acts 17:23, and while I was passing through, Paul back to Athens, he says, while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, all these idols and stuff like that, he says, I also found one, in case you missed any of them, to one unknown God. Man, talk about ignorant worship. You know, let's put out one more just in case we missed any. And then when Paul is trying to tell them about the one true God, they scoff. What therefore you worship in ignorance, Paul says, this I proclaim to you, the one true one that you missed. Paul also describes will worship. This is when people do what they want. This is not only ignorant, in vain, it is illogical because it's based on one's desires. This is when their God is their own ambition based on lusts and desires. So there's no logic to it. They just want what they want to want. Okay? So they change the Lord's Supper. You know, they change what they eat. They change what they do. They like musical instruments. They like dancing. What did they do in Corinth? Well, can't tell you because the little kids are here. But, you know, find out sometime what the expression, like a Corinthian meant. This is what Paul dealt with in that city. Colossians 2:23, there are matters which have to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion, in self-abasement, and so severe treatment of the body. You know, the people think this ought to help. You know, I mean, that's what the priests of Baal were doing. They were cutting themselves. There are people that, you know, beat themselves for worship or, you know, cut themselves or walk on fire or, you know, offer their children, you know, to the fire or whatever. Seem like the best they could do, you know, for whatever their God is, instead of just, you know, going to God and asking, you know, what is it you want? Philippians 3:18-19 talks about desires, you know, and fleshly indulgence. And he says their God is their belly. You know, they may have a stone thing, but what they're really feeding is themselves. And there was a time when Jesus' enemies clothed him in the garments of a king and made obeisance to him. However, it was sarcastic and cruel, not meant in truth, but as a form of ridicule. It was mock worship. Mark 15, and they kept, this is the Roman soldiers, beating his head with a rod, spitting on him, kneeling and bowing before him. And after they had mocked him, they took the purple off him and put his garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him. Galatians 6 warns God is not mocked. You sow to the wind, you'll reap a whirlwind. All sorts of destruction will come if you try to do it the wrong way. The scriptures also enlighten us about what is true worship, the kind that God desires and expects from those who truly love him. John 4:23 says, "An hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth." Because God's a spirit. He wants worship in spirit and truth. That's true worship. The truth has to be there. You got to go according to what God lays out. The spirit has to be there because it goes in tandem with the truth. That is how you do it. Earnestly, sincerely, honestly, meekly, humbly. Those are all terms that God uses in order for the spirit of man, what it has to be in order to come to God. You may have the truth, but if you don't have the spirit, the truth's not going to do you any work good. You can be all loving and have, you know, that kind of a spirit involved in it, but if the truth isn't there, it's not going to do you any good. God says the both have to be there. You can be right on in your doctrine, but if your attitude is wrong, it's all wrong. Or you can have a right attitude, but how can you have a right attitude if it's not to do what God tells you to? That's why the two go together. They're two opposite poles of the same thing. And this goes along, too, with... I say this as a cursory look at this because there's things obviously we missed about the nature of God. We totally circumvented the fact that, that God is love. I mean, big part of it. God is love. And we have to keep that uppermost in mind, that he wants what's best for us, and he's put a plan in place in order for us to have the very best. James says he's the father of all good things, all good gifts, without shifting shadow. I mean, it's just, there's nothing that influences that. He wants the best for us. And he took the time to lay in from the foundation of the world a plan. Some call it a scheme, but it's not a, some scheme connotes something cunning or whatever. But it was a design, you know, that God had put forward in order for man to plug into, to access the love of God. You know, this is why he sent his son and why Jesus died for us, because that's all part of the plan, something that had to be implemented in order to bring about how can we as sinful people approach a holy God. See, with God, all things are possible. You know, he made allowances for it. But notice the other side too. He is a awesome God. He is a fearful God. He is a God that hates things that are done wrong. Proverbs 6, 7 things that God hates. Okay. We take in the whole nature of God, and then we're prepared for any eventuality. What Paul said when Jesus comes with his angels in flaming fire, he will take vengeance on those who do not know God and who do not obey his gospel. Two things there. Okay. Do you really know God? Do you know all the aspects about him, or at least all that he's revealed to us? You've got to take him into consideration. Yeah. Is he loving? Yes. But does he want things done his way? Yeah, he's a jealous God. He won't allow you to worship any other kind of God. You can't marry the things of the world with the things of God. He expects one to come to him properly, the way he's outlined. And this is what we try to do here in the church. You know, the worship is set up to be done exactly the way God said for us to do it. Now, just to do it would just make it a meaningless ritual. Why, say, like Dan this morning is trying to bring out the essence of, you know, what the things represent, what we need to listen in prayer, what people are saying as they address God. The songs that we sing, you know, many of them praise to God. Is your heart into it with the right kind of attitude? This is what God is looking for. This is the spirit and truth. know, is the messages that we listen to things that God would approve of? You know, the apostles' doctrine. This is what we're trying to achieve and what we're trying to do is help other people with and to understand. And much of it begins with, you know, of understanding what God is trying to teach, acquiescing to it, repenting of the way we're living with the world, you know, pulling ourselves away from that, confessing Christ as our Lord, you know, the only one we're going to listen to, and then enter the waters of baptism. We got, you know, water back here so that you can be buried with him and then rise up to a newness of life. What do you think that implies? Living the same way you did before you were baptized? If you do, you just got wet. A newness of life means you've fully committed yourself to serving God to the best of your ability. You know, there's going to be some slips. I mean, face it, there are times we're tired, and we just want to lay down or sit in the corner and suck our thumb or whatever. You know, God understands that. You know, he's just looking for us, you know, to understand that we need to be doing the right thing as best as we can at the time. And with that, you know, we help each other. This is why we have a support group that God set up before man even thought of support groups. We've got that into psychology. We have a support group to help us to be there, to motivate each other, to strengthen each other, and we have God. Man, to be able to plug into God like Elijah did. I mean, that's what we're striving for, to make our lives in such a way that we know that God listens to us. So this is what we're trying for. This is what our goal is. This is what our effort should be, why we need to be here as much as possible. I mean, the first century example was every day. I mean, we crab about Wednesdays, you have to be there, or Sunday night or whatever. In the first century, they loved God so much, they realized how precious it was, the thing that they now had, as opposed to, you know, what they had before, that they wanted a part of it every day. So, anything we can do, you know, please let us know as we take the time to stand now and sing our closing prayer, our song.